Studies in Occult Philosophy by G. de Purukar. Questions and Answers. 12 Globes in a Chain. In Fundamentals of the Esoteric Philosophy you give 12 globes. In one of the letters in the Mahatma letters the master says there are 14 in all, that the number has been given out correctly for the first time. Would that mean 2, or rather 4, connecting the lower and higher hierarchies, instead of 2? It puzzles me rather. Looking up letter 14 I now understand that the number 14 relates to the 7 lokas and the 7 tulas. Is that right? There is no need for being confused about this, although I readily see how confusion might arise. The number of globes is 12, but the master, in the letter that you speak of, refers to the 7 manifest globes of which HPB herself almost invariably writes, and also to the world of effects which are not lokas or actual spheres, but inner parts of the constitution of each globe. Much as a man's astral body is one of the principles of his constitution and yet not different from him. Where you say that I now understand that the number 14 relates to the 7 tulas and the 7 lokas. Is that right? Is quite correct, because the 7 lokas and the 7 tulas include the principles both of any globe and of any man. But I must point out that the master, in the quotation which you make from him, is more particularly referring to the worlds of effects or astral worlds, commonly grouped under the name astral light, than he is to the lokas and tulas specifically. Nevertheless, the lokas and tulas are almost the same thing. The matter is very involved, so it is small wonder that you should be puzzled. If you will look in the Mahatma letters, on page 71, at the bottom of the page, you will see that the Master M states specifically, the worlds of effects are not lokas or localities. Remember then, that there are actually 12 globes, 7 of them manifest, and 5 unmanifest, at least to us human beings, but that the quotation from the master's letter refers rather to the particular lokas and tulas conjoined which are to every globe its own specific worlds of effects, the astral world and its connections with the other parts of a globe's constitution of 7 principles. Explanation of Heaven and Hell. If you are asked by a Christian what you have to give in place of their heaven, what would you reply, please? May I answer this question by phrasing my answer not so much as an answer but as an explanation, inversely as it were. The Christian heaven, a place of peace and bliss where the righteous shall dwell through eternity with a recognition of the glory of God Almighty upon their souls, and bathing in the spiritual elevation that they are one with him and in his holy favor. How narrow! Would not the very angels, according to the Christian system, turn in horror from such spiritual selfishness? Think of the millions and millions and millions of uncounted hosts and multitudes of suffering creatures who have not attained such or any heaven and who, according to the Christian theory, the orthodox theory, are undergoing the pangs of an inextinguishable fire, burning in unspeakable torture to time without an ending. How can there be a heaven when such hellish conditions prevail? Forgive me if I offend, I do not mean to. I am no believer in such a heaven. I reject it because my whole soul rises in revolt. I want no heaven unless every entity everywhere, unless every thinking and sentient soul, shares it with me. The self-isolated saint in his holy heaven lives in a paradise of fools, and of very selfish fools. Give me rather our own grand, sublime teaching of the gods, that there is eternal progress, that there is eternal evolution, eternal advancement, eternal growth, eternal unfolding of faculty after faculty, of power after power, of constantly increasing expansion of the human consciousness into the divine consciousness, and of the divine into the super divine, and so on unto endless time. Give me our sublime teaching that as we grow and expand and our consciousness takes unto itself cosmic reaches, we become co-laborers in the cosmic labor, in the cosmic work. Ah, there is a vision to enchant the soul, there is a vision to rest the heart, there is a vision which stimulates the intellect, the recognition of one's oneness with the universe. Endless progress, endless advancement for all, excluding none, the tiniest atom, the mightiest God, two different stages of growing entities. The atom becomes a man, the man becomes a god, the god becomes a super god, and so on ad infinitum. There is no place for a static heaven in my philosophy, and on the same grounds as there is no place for a static hell in my belief. There are of course the intermediate spheres and stages of bliss and felicity where we rest, for instance in the Devachan after death, or in the Nirvana, but all these are transitory as compared with beginningless and endless duration. Of course there are temporary heavens, and there are likewise temporary hells. If a man follows through many ages a path which takes him constantly downward, a path in following which there is constant increase in pain and suffering because a constant constriction of every faculty and energy, becoming more and more tightened into oneself. There are indeed these things, but even they are temporary. And the same reflection applies to the ascending path, towards the heavens innumerable. But as compared with eternity they are, to follow a favorite metaphor of mine, but like dissolving wisps of cloud upon a mountainside. They come, they endure a moment, and they pass. Far greater than any such heaven, than any such sphere or loka of bliss and felicity, is the grandiose vision of endless growth in faculty and power, and endless opportunity to work for the world. There is no joy like that. Man a host of monads. How may we reach to an understanding of the essence of us, of each one of us, which is beyond what we call the monad? Or can we reach beyond the monad? This is a question which has bothered some of our most intellectual students. Yet the answer is very simple. You have the answer in Fundamentals of the Esoteric Philosophy and of course in all of HPB's philosophical works. Have I not often said that man's real nature or composition is legion? That he is a composite entity, and that within every human constitution there is not merely one monad but many, one essential monad, the root of the individual's being, giving birth to hosts of children monads, and that these children monads build up the vehicles in which the primal or primordial essential monad lives and works. Have I not often pointed out that man is a composite of an actual army of entities, of a host, of a multitude, extending from the heart of the universe down to his physical brain and body? To illustrate, there is the astral monad which the beast has or is conscious of in itself. There is the human monad which we humans have and are conscious in. There is the spiritual monad which the great masters, the higher ones at least, are because they are conscious in it. There is the divine monad, in the consciousness of which the inner God of each one of us lives. There is the super divine monad in which some entity, still a part of us, still more sublime, is conscious and lives, and so on forever. The difficult thing in this study is to get it through our dull human intelligences so miseducated through hundreds of years, that man is a composite or compounded entity, a microcosm. That we are not merely animated bodies built in a certain way by natural forces, but that we actually are rays. I cannot think of a better term. Flowing forth from the heart of infinity, and that for each one of us such a ray is our essential self, and along this ray, so to say, at certain intervals there are knots of consciousness. Each one of these knots along the ray is a child monad, and the farther one goes inwards or, in other words, the higher one goes, along this ray of consciousness, the diviner the monads are found to be as we reach knot after knot of consciousness ascending upwards or inwards. Now then, as the human being yearning for more light and truth spiritualizes his consciousness, in other words rises to higher planes of consciousness, he ascends along this essential ray and becomes cognizant, first, that he is more than a merely beast monad, or later in time that he is more than a merely human monad. There is in him the consciousness of the monad of the masters, the spiritual monad, and when he becomes a master he realizes that there is something within him still higher than this, to wit, the God monad, and as he continues to ascend along this ray of consciousness, this pathway about which I wrote so much in Fundamentals and elsewhere, as he goes still higher, with each ascent, with each step upwards, with each reaching to a higher monad, he attains an added expansion of essential consciousness. Thus this expansion grows from humanity into spirituality or into masterhood, from spirituality his consciousness becomes divine in its reach, including even the galaxy or Milky Way. He then ascends still higher along this essential selfhood, along this ray within him, until his consciousness becomes cosmic and takes in a reach still more vast, and so on forever. The teaching is an amazing paradox and an amazing verity. Remember that of course a paradox is not a contradiction. A paradox means a statement which contains at least two elements contradictory apparently, but only apparently so because we don't understand the two elements. When we understand it, the paradox disappears and we see their coherence in the unity of conception. If I rightly understand it, it comes to this. When we use the word monad, it represents the relatively highest state of consciousness which the being in question has reached at the time, but of course as an evolving being, yet it always represents the highest attained at the time. Exactly so. There is always a monad superior to our stage of evolution, whatever that stage may be. There is always one still higher just ahead of us. In other words, it is the principle of veil after veil, each veil hiding a nobler vision, a grander expansion of consciousness, and all evolution is simply an unveiling of consciousness, an unfolding of potentialities, of potencies hitherto lying enfolded, involved. This then, is what evolution means. Unfolding, unwrapping from within of what hitherto has lain latent there, or rather unmanifest. Overlapping in geological periods. Would you say that there is any overlapping in the great geological periods, or is each one entirely distinct from the one which follows it? It can perhaps be said that the geological periods overlap, but such overlapping is minor in manifestation. The main point to remember is that the different great stocks of mineral, vegetable, and animal and human lives follow each other with coincident or coordinate great changes of land and sea, and therefore also of climates. In other words, the stocks of beings, or monads, cooperate or coordinate, and thus produce the different and serial and successive patterns of what we today call geological eras, or what the biologist or zoologist and botanist would call the successive waves of plant and animal and human life. Thus there are successive geologic eras, each one accompanied by its own monadic families in all the kingdoms, but there are survivals in any one geologic epoch for long periods, of the preceding epoch and even preceding epochs. For instance, the elephant today and the rhinoceros, while still alive, as beings really belong to a preceding time. They are slowly dying out. The reason of their survival is that the monads inhabiting these bodies were able to conform to the new mammalian era. Certain other types of living beings have died out, or almost died out, like the dodo or the platypus and kangaroos in instances, although the kangaroos still hang on. No communication with the dead. Do you think one is ever justified in consulting mediums in order to, rather, in the effort to communicate with the deceased? I can answer this by saying that it is the teaching of the wisdom religion of mankind, today called theosophy, that any attempt to communicate with those who have passed on, by mediums or sensitives, or in any other wise, is a cruel injustice, perpetrated, alas, usually in ignorance, upon souls which are struggling to wing their way into brighter and grander spheres. And any such effort, even if only moderately successful, holds the departing spiritual essence back. Furthermore, it is utterly impossible, by nature's grand and compassionate laws, physically to communicate with the spiritual essence of any human being, for when such spiritual essence has broken its links with the material world at the death of the physical body, which is cast aside as a worn-out garment, the spiritual essence cannot ever be materially reached at all. The utmost that could be done would be a psychomagnetic communication with the astral reliquiae, or what the consensus of mankind has called the spook or the Buddha. Please understand that this answer to your question is in no wise intended to be a slur upon the many splendid and kindly people who belong to the so-called spiritualistic ranks. I would not hurt their feelings for anything, and yet I am in duty bound, as a theosophical teacher, when a question is asked of me, to tell honestly and without reserve what the teachings of the wisdom religion of mankind are. I may add this as a comment to what I have just written, that there is, nevertheless, a sublime way of coming into heart touch with those whom we have loved and who have passed on, and that is through our own spiritual nature, in other words by raising our hearts in impersonal love towards the memory, the blessed memory, of those whom we have loved, and who are no longer physically with us. There is a real spiritual companionship, an actual one, if those left behind in the physical body can be so impersonal and loving of heart that they can do this. The spirit is universal in its reaches, and love overleaps all boundaries either of space or time, and thus even the living on earth can come into loving spiritual touch with the ones who are freed. But any attempt to do this through mediums or through psychics or sensitives, etc., I feel in duty bound to tell you is not only unfortunate misjudgment but deleterious to the spiritual health of both the medium and the one who so tries. Alas that there should be such ignorance of nature's great laws among people who are otherwise in so many cases devoted kindly, splendid people. Divinity, spirit and soul. What is the difference between the divine and spiritual on the one hand, and the spirit and the soul on the other hand? The words divine and spiritual of course are adjectives. Whatever is of the spirit is spiritual. The divine is a very different thing from the soul. Soul is one of the most difficult words in the English language to explain, simply because it means a thousand and one things. Say soul, and 50,000 men will have 50,000 different opinions about it. However, we may speak of soul as the center or habitat of an ego which is the soul's inspiring flame. The encircling veil or garment is soul, and as each man has within his constitution a divine ego and a spiritual ego and a human ego and even a sort of beast ego, there are corresponding souls for all these. Soul, we may say therefore, means garment, vehicle, body. The divine, I may perhaps say, is the loftiest part either of the universe or of man. Whatever is of the gods, is of divine character. Whatever is of the nature of divinity, is divine. The highest in any hierarchy is the divine, then comes the spiritual through which it works. Underneath that, let us say in our own case, comes the human, through which the spiritual works, then the beast element in us, the astral vital part, through which the human must work in order to express itself on this physical plane. Then comes our physical body. I hope the answer is somewhat responsive at least. Prayer and petitioning. Why do theosophists not believe in prayer, and that prayer will be answered by our Father in heaven? Just exactly what do you mean by prayer? Does it mean petitioning the Father of men and the Creator of the universe to send us rain or to give us success in our material enterprises, or to send us a baby boy instead of a baby girl, or to make the crops grow green or to give us comfort and solace when perhaps death has taken a loved one from us? What kind of prayer is this? It is wholly selfish. It is a confession that we are seeking to get something for ourselves. It is a confession also that our view of and opinions about and convictions concerning that unnameable mystery, whose very heart is compassion and wisdom, are purely human. It also signifies that we believe that the divine does not know as well as we do what is good for the world and for us. petitionary prayer, to us theosophists, is not only wrong, but if we may use ordinary human terms, is a spiritual impertinence. On the other hand, those who suffer, whose hearts grieve, who are in doubt about some deep ethical problem, who are uncertain after which manner a certain act should be done, should remember the words of all the great teachers: "Go into thine own inner chamber and there commune with the God within thyself, for, as Jesus is reported to have said, I and my Father are one." That is, each man is one with his own inner God, the essential divinity within him, his link with the boundless infinitude. There is a fountain of wisdom within us all, a fountain of love inexhaustible, and the pity of it is that men do not realize this, one of the sublimest truths of human life. They do not know what they have within, and all the teaching of the sages and seers of the ages has been: look within, search within, find truth within, become one with thine own inner God, and be at peace. There is the source of wisdom and love and peace and happiness, and the way to reach this source is beginning with a boundless sympathy for the souls of men. The one true and only genuine prayer is loving: give love boundless to everything both great and small, feel your essential unity with the stars in their courses, feel at home in the universe, have a kindly thought and a compassionate feeling for everything that suffers or is in pain, or that grieves or that yearns for light and truth. This is the path of discipleship, this is the ideal of the Chela life. Theosophy makes an appeal to the spirit within man himself, and if this idea is understood and developed within one, then in a little while light comes, peace comes, happiness comes, and great quiet. No longer do pain and sorrow exist in such a man or woman. The key is self-forgetfulness. Remember that the very heart of nature is harmony, which means love, for love and harmony are one, being two sides of the same thing. Wisdom is but another name for the same thing, for love is wise. It is wisdom and clairvoyance, and wisdom is always harmonious. Actually, love and wisdom and peace and harmony are really words for the same inexpressible mystery which men in their ignorance call God. When we begin to delineate it and define it, we endow the divine with our merely human figments of thought, imperfect, limited, because we are imperfect, and therefore it is that we theosophists always speak of this wondrous ineffable mystery by the one word, that. This is infinitely more reverential than to begin to label the divine or to ticket it or to qualify it with the imperfect attributes of our human existence. All petitionary prayer is, in the last analysis, selfish. Take two armies on a battlefield, for instance. Each one prays that it may be victorious and the enemy be vanquished. Whose prayer is your God going to grant? I repeat again. All petitionary prayer is selfish. A man may ask for guidance, but even this is for himself alone. It is a nobler prayer, I admit, than if he were to ask for an increase in his wealth, or something of that sort, but nevertheless he is asking for something which in his imperfect judgment he thinks to be the best thing for him. But you can yourselves change the course of your own lives, because you are a part of nature, you are an integral part of the universe, and therefore a part of that very heart of compassion, although as yet very imperfect and feeble expressions of it. Even if you pray for another's good fortune, how about the moral aspect of this? Don't you realize that you have no right deliberately to influence, or to try to influence, the evolutionary growth or development of a brother or of an entity inferior to you, unless it be strictly in accordance with nature's inner laws, which are non-interference with others, except in loving and in compassion and in impersonal helping? Do you think you could have a right to influence a rose, for instance, to change its color from red to blue? If so, then following along the same line, you would have a right to influence some human being's destiny, and to try to change him from a bad man to a good man or from a good man to a bad man. No, we theosophists say no, because, suppose that you were successful in changing a bad man into a good one, and did so by your own power, you would leave him still weak and imperfect, and you would thus deprive him of the opportunity of gaining strength for himself, which is the only genuine strength and the only way by which he can grow. It is in nature's law for him to learn his own lessons, to evolve himself, to strive himself for strength, for light, for growth. Interference in the affairs of another is unwarrantable, and the very gods in their majestic courses cannot and will not interfere with the evolutionary growth of men by listening to their feeble petitionary prayer.